This is Philosophy versus Improv, where two sages try to teach each other a thing or two, and maybe you, the audience, get something out of it as well.
Hey, this is Mark Lintzenmeyer, serving as your primary focus for the philosophical energy coming from the universe today.
I am Mary Hines, and I am bringing the improvisational energy.
But we are doing sort of a prismatic sort of thing. We have a familiar voice.
Hello, this is Seth. Secondary philosophical energy, I guess.
I mean, the secondary. It's all in the circuit. Yeah, so folks who've heard the Partially Examined Life will probably recognize that Seth is a longtime co-host of mine there, but has never been on this show. Had you even listened to this show? Be honest.
Two episodes.
Okay.
But a long time ago when you first started, and I don't remember exactly which ones they were.
Yes, very memorable. That's great.
But probably it was when my improvisation was quite bad. So this should make you feel more comfortable about the addition that it's, you know, it's the talking, it's the free form talking like we do in the nightcap stuff, but we're adding an element.
And the implication there is that your improvisation has become good. Is that?
I mean, I've done it for 4 years, so it's less intolerable. Let me put it that way. It doesn't necessarily make me cringe. But Mary can help make sure that we newbies, some which are slightly newer than others, don't fall into a giant pit of despair.
Gotcha.
Yeah, because there's no snacks in the pit of despair. And honestly, it's really dirty. And it's just the pit of despair is not up to code. And honestly, that's my bad for letting that slip. And I'm sorry.
I'm fairly certain the pit of despair is in my front yard.
Oh, is it? Well, it's a floating location.
Yes. Well, at least temporarily. And that's what's been... I had to have an electrician come out. And he climbed down into the pit of despair.
To light your pit of despair, because it is so much nicer when you have some little colored lights up in the pit of despair.
Exactly.
Yeah. I rewatched The Princess Bride the other day. Oh, golly gosh. It's so amazing. So my brain immediately goes to pit of despair. Like, ooh, it's such a delicious movie.
Yes. I watched that, I want to say last year, with my then 6-year-old daughter.
What does she think?
Well, I think she was kind of like, eh, it was okay, but she didn't quite connect to it the way that I had hoped, but that was maybe a bit young for her.
Sure.
But man, you're right. It totally holds up. I mean, this is now what, 40 years, 30 years, I don't even know. And I still say, have fun storming the castle.
It's just amazing. Like, I've really been focusing on any of the media that I ingest, that it's something that is nourishing and healing. And I love watching and rewatching things based off of the cast. Like Mandy Patinkin is an absolute improv god and a lovely human. And I've also been focusing too on like, do I know that that actor is a good person? Like Cary Elwes is no, I have a couple people who are friends with him and he's known for being just a delightful human. And I'm like, well, now I want to support you because I know you're also a nice human.
And you have shown yourself to be authentic because you know how to pronounce that guy's name.
Yeah.
Which I've never heard it pronounced that way.
Yeah.
No, everybody really? Else that I talked are just Elwes or something.
Can you send me a gold sticker? I'd really love a gold star sticker, please. I'll put it up on my corkboard.
Now, I happen to know that, Seth, maybe some of the things are nourishing, but you also spend a lot of time reading stuff about genocides and how we're all descending into totalitarianism. And do you do that in the pit of despair? Does it just let you look down into the pit of despair and see your own reflection?
I do it near the pit of despair, but not in the pit of despair because I have a bad back and
sure.
There aren't any comfortable chairs.
Yeah.
But no, yes, it is, I guess, hobby probably isn't the right word to say I have a hobby of reading about genocide and extermination. No, it's an interest of mine. In fact, it's the interest of mine. Why are human beings so absolutely terrible to themselves and to everything else on the planet? And because it has happened throughout the history of human, let's just say, self-consciousness and is actively happening now, it's particularly front of mind.
Is there anything in what you've been reading and researching? I know sometimes we look at something and then a point will pop out to us that is of interest. What is of interest to you in what you've been researching?
Well, it's really about how certain specific concepts are used over and over again to justify these types of actions. Things like property, agriculture, rights, God, you know, kind of all the ones you would suspect. anything, it just, they are used to dehumanize an other and make it a lot easier for you to perpetrate violence and crimes against them. And so that's what really interests me, is what's special about our language and our use of concepts that allows us to turn individual, particular, loving human beings into categories that we can then annihilate.
Yeah. And then the audacity of that group of humans to assert authority and superiority over any other different group.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's all about the pit of despair. We need to get better chairs in the pit of despair, because those folding lawn chairs are just really uncomfortable.
And we need to make it bigger. Either everybody's in or everybody's out, but we can't have some people in and some people out.
No, you can't. Mark, are you in the pit or are you out?
I'm thinking that a pit, as a metaphor, as a construction, doesn't capture it. It needs to be some sort of a beamed, you know, ubiquitous, a medium of despair, a gas of despair. A gas disperses very widely. And you could just make it a little bit. You could just put so many parts, just like how many crickets are in your Oreo, how many cricket legs, parts per the nitrogen, oxygen, despair. So everybody can smell it still. It's everywhere. We can blow it away from the more prosperous areas or more despairing areas to spread it out, so everybody just feels a little bad. Is that what you're getting at?
Wasn't that Brave New World? Isn't there, they use scents or something like that to, So you're just talking about, how could we flood the world with Hermes and make everybody feel really, really great about themselves, as opposed to, trash compactors or the back streets.
I think that's one of my missions, is to counteract to use your gas analogy, Mark, the icky gas with joy gas, which then makes me think of, what's the one, the Batman that has Joker, when they're in the museum and he gives her the mask and he's like, put it on now. And then like the gas goes out and kills everyone.
Was that the original
one?
Jack Nicholson. Yeah.
And Michael Keaton, right?
Yeah. So I think in terms of you could easily let your power leak out. And I'm focusing that my power is on joy. Like right now I'm wearing a blonde and blue wig and pink lipstick. And it's like, you know, I choose to radiate joy to counteract the yuck.
And I choose to support and amplify that.
Yeah.
In the true spirit of improv.
Yes.
Yes. It's more fun to be around people like Mary than people like me.
Well, that's just real sweet. That's so
It's
real
a different
sweet.
Kind of fun. I mean, that's why I think, so it seemed like Mary, you're I want to take in only nourishing things that would rule out some people. I think comparable to Seth's fascination with genocide are people who are really into true crime.
Well, and you make a great point, because when I say nourishing, it can be different kinds of nourishment. Mm. Like sometimes what's really nourishing for me is dark space sci-fi horror, which Mark, you and I talked about in the last thing. So it's about medicating with the kind of entertainment that is going to spark and inspire me and not push me down into the pit. And sometimes I'm in a headspace where ooh, I just really want to watch people make terrible decisions in space, but save the cat. You know, sometimes I really, that is nourishing to me. And sometimes rewatching The Sword in the Stone is exactly what I need. So that's what I, to qualify that.
How about Mission Impossible? Are any of the Mission Impossible movies ever nourishing? Because as a callback to your Cary Elwes.
Oh, I see.
Princess Bride.
He's, slow down, he's in the last,
he's in the last two episodes. The final two, yeah.
Okay, I'll have to check
Director
it out.
Director of National Intelligence or something like
I'll
that.
I'll have to check it out.
He looks great, by the way. Very handsome. Very, very handsome.
I love that.
Dressed.
Also, that's another thing, too, is I feel like we reflect, our physicality reflects our inner spirit. And, you know, you can kind of tell if someone is toxic and icky by the color of their eyes and their skin and how they hold their body and how they speak and what they say when they speak. So I feel Cary Elwes being like, oh, he looks great to me. That is an obvious reflection of inner work and peace. A piece of work.
I hear the same thing about Hugh Jackman.
Oh, God, he's delicious.
That's a good example of the kind of philosophical theory that has been put out in the past that can be used for whimsy or for evil, right?
Sure.
The outer form reflects the inner virtue, which is just
plain. Ooh, I like that. The outer form reflects the inner
false
virtue.
in many circumstances, right? The beauty's only skin deep. You know, we're familiar with the limitations of that. So I'm wondering about that sort of thing that one can say that is true in some circumstances, true for some purposes. Does it count? Is that the kind of thing, Seth, as philosopher, you would say, no, that's the hoi polloi. That's not how you use that term. Doing it wrong. Or is that something to actually run with?
I would say qualified. You can't just say if somebody's outer appearance does not conform to the conventional standards of beauty, that they have no virtue, right? Because that's what the Greeks would say.
Yes.
If you're beautiful, you were good. And if you were ugly, you were bad. And that's not what we want to say. What Mary is referring to is a type of expression, a kind of physical expression of an inner state, which can manifest in terms of light in the eyes or a kind of posture or whatever. And that's totally consistent. In fact, I was just listening to our old Levinas episode, right? Do you remember the encounter in the face with the particular other, et cetera, the eyes are the window to the soul. So there is definitely a very robust and quite defensible philosophical position about how the soul shines through, so to speak.
Hey, it's me, Bronchi, you know, your favorite golem. I have my 2 o'clock appointment at the beautification bar. Whose chair am I sitting in?
This is this is my chair. I invite you to come in. I will make you as beautiful outside as you are inside.
Oh, you know, that's great because I've been doing a lot of evil shit lately and I certainly don't feel beautiful. Is this your assistant?
Yes, this is a Seth tonic. He mostly holds the tonics. He provides the raw materials. He does a little light carpentry when required.
Wow. Got a real firm handshake, too. Sorry about my talons.
I am also responsible for unclogging the toilet.
Oh, yeah. You know, I took a big shit down in my pit of despair before I got here because I'm really trying to be a better gremlin. You know, I'm trying real, real hard.
All right. So you say you have done terrible things. Are these actually terrible things or are these just, how terrible I was because you're very saucy.
It's pretty terrible. Just on my way here, I ran out of coffee. So I was feeling particularly cranky and I knocked over a school bus of 10-year-olds. I'm not proud.
And this is a metaphorical school bus.
No, it's an actual school bus of children coming back from summer camp. That's what you know, the sirens you hear. That's my fault.
All right, so it seems like you are already, your appearance matches this foul deed.
That's the problem.
Nothing to do here.
Can you do something about my fur? You know, I'm thinking maybe some highlights.
Yes, I think you could do that. You could do some highlights. You can also trim and perhaps clean them. I have already covered the chair in plastic.
Oh, thank you. I tend to ooze when I'm nervous. I'm sorry about that.
Tonicus, this is beyond my ethical purview. I know you are the one who unclogs the toilets. Do you want to unclog this person here?
I could use some unclogging.
Absolutely. Turn over.
Do you want belly up or do you want my back? Which way do you want me?
Hands down, ass up.
Oh.
And so the scene ends before we have to witness or act out this too literal unclogging. My, oh my.
Seth, you did great.
You caught me off guard, but...
well, see, that's kind of the point. To do my thing here as like teaching through improvisation, the whole philosophy is leap before you know where you're going to land. You jump into the thing that, and as I teach it in terms of what feels sparkly, what feels shiny, what feels interesting. And as we were talking, I was extracting, like my brain immediately went to a monster beauty bar where creatures go to get beautified. Mm. So I had no idea how it was going to play out. I had no idea who my character was going to be. You just initiate with one choice and then you show up to the gifts that are made available because you've taken the leap.
You know, of course, the amateur thing that you hear, the one rule of yes and, well, in the scene, it doesn't mean that the character has to always say yes and, because this was clearly...
Yeah.
Based on what had been sketched out in the 5 seconds of what this environment was, of making your inner beauty or making outer beauty reflect your inner beauty, then this was a request, the request that the primary character came in making that did not make sense according to my understanding of that environment. And so I think one character rejecting another is fine. That's not saying no to the performer.
We are creating new rules. We're creating a space that's never existed before. So we don't get to bring our expectation of what something is supposed to look like. We get to be in discovery as an ensemble together. And to add to what you're saying about yes and, Mark, yes doesn't mean all sparkly, shiny, yes, yes. Yes means accepting the last offer that has been given and building off of it. You don't need to agree with it, but you must accept that it is the given reality, and then you lay the next brick down. In Second City, we say, bring a brick, not a cathedral. We're building one brick at a time together.
What is it about that particular, I'm going to call it form of presence, because it's truly, you know, you're creating something sort of in real time, which means you're actively present. You have to be actively present, I would assume, with the other actors, that's different from doing, say, a play or a traditional, you know, proscenium type stage play or something.
So
like
I think of improvisation, and I'm a classically trained actor, so that's the root of my training. And improvisation is acting without a script. So when something is written, someone has already sat and like looked at the plot points and ironed it out, right? In improvisation, we are aware that there, you know, the scene begins, we see the characters, we get some exposition, but it's not a normal day, it's a different day. And then something is introduced, and then we get about 3 points of rising action or so until we hit a moment of transformation where one character or all characters have changed and changed forever. So that is like the general story format. So as an improviser, I'm aware of that, but I'm not holding it as gospel. I just know that I'm open to a point of transformation. So while it is improvised, there is a skeletal structure that the muscles are attached to.
Mm-hmm.
You've been through one diet after another, maybe for years. You've counted calories, pushed through workouts, cut carbs, and still the weight came back. It's exhausting. You've been told it's about willpower, but really, it's about science. With Voy's weight loss program, we combine medication with expert support to help you reach your goals. We don't believe in one-size-fits-all solutions. Voy's medication is personalized based on what's right for you. You'll have a full care team behind you, from Voy's clinicians checking in on you to a personal coach keeping you motivated. And with the Voy app, your team is always just a tap away, anytime, anywhere. Join over 100,000 people across the UK already seeing results with Voy at joinvoy.com/podcast. Unsure if it's right for you? Check your eligibility today at joinvoy.com/podcast. Treatments will only be prescribed if deemed appropriate.
In a traditional play, you might try to identify or come up with a backstory for the character. In other words, you're inhabiting the character. Do you immediately go and inhabit the character when you start to improv, whatever persona, whatever it is that you take on?
You immediately, my philosophy, my point, because I'm very character centric. I'm very character focused. So I completely saturate myself in the point of view of that character. And I think if this is true, then what else is true? Like what launched it is, what if there was a monster who was outwardly really like vile and awful, but just wanted to be seen and appreciated and be less evil? And then we explore that point of view. So what's important is to discover a point of view and double down on that and explore and heighten that.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I seem to try to know what to say next in these situations is not that different than on the Philosophy Podcast or something. I mean, yes, you could consult your notes and sort of see what is next, but mostly it's trying to say something that coherently expands on what has already been set up.
Yes.
So whether it's the character, like she was just saying, or the setting, I kind of like gimmicky settings where we, you know, there's some telos, there's some internal purposiveness to the setting that you can then inquire about. Like the character could even just ask a question about it or just put forth a hypothesis about it by doing the next thing that you think would be appropriate there. So figuring out like what your role, Seth, even though Mary, you know, sort of, oh, is this your assistant? Like, okay, let's figure out what the Seth character is. What Tonicus is that? I don't know which name I started with, but that's what I ended up, what he's actually supposed to be doing there.
I'm actually going to be teaching a class on this soon. I've taught it and I'm refining it. And I'm going to be working, it's going to be online. So there'll be a lot, you know, easy access to it. I think I'm going to call it, It Makes Sense. And it's about using your five senses, like using the environment. So like you said, I saw us in this hoity-toity salon. So if you get in your head and you don't know what to say next, reach out, look out, listen, taste, touch, smell the environment. Like, you know, so the assistant might go, oh, could I interest you in some lemon water from the cooler?
Oh, yeah, I really like lemon. It's antioxidant rich.
Right. So the environment is just as much an assistant. And another point, too, I like to think about to what Mark was saying is a scene is a sandbox. And so, Seth, you come along and you put down your prized velociraptor. It is my job to play with that velociraptor. Screw the truck that we were just playing with. Like that truck's over there. We can bring the truck in if we want, but it's about playing with the most recent gift that was dropped into the sandbox that is the scene. Also dinosaurs. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Doesn't make it any less terrifying than it was 20 minutes ago.
New things are scary. Being out of your comfort zone is scary. I think being outside of the realm of like, I've already thought this and planned this out. But I think it's also really valuable to shake us up out of like the track that we're in and challenge yourself and trust yourself that you'll know what to say when it's time to say it. And you won't know it until it's time because it's not time yet.
So to relate this back to the philosophy, I was trying to explain a little bit to Mary how philosophy is similar to what everybody does when they think about culturally important issues. The existence of God, blah, 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 that, you know, the kind of thing that comes in contact with us every day. And what then we want to add to that to say, yes, you are already sort of doing philosophy, but now here's 3,000 years of history that can make this better. And some of it just comes down to how picky are you being? So, right, we could have stopped in the scene, in the discussion to, wait a second, you said something that was a little wrong there. Let's pick this apart. And it's a matter of sort of picking your battles that, but that is the entry point of, you know, I'm going to write a whole philosophical paper on this that dwells longer than a normal person probably thinks is worth to dwell on this one little picky issue. Does that seem accurate, Seth? So she said the thing about inner beauty, outer beauty, and you immediately, oh, connect this up with what the Greek said, and let's get sort of the extent to which it is true. So it's about philosophers clarify. Let me just clarify this. Let me lay down as you just did.
Yeah, I think obviously there are going to be a number of truisms and idioms and certain kinds of cultural stances that people commonly have a touch point to that philosophers have spent more time. But I think it's going a little bit too far to say that we're just doing what everybody's already doing, just in a more picky way. Because I do think that what philosophers do is what a lot of people resist doing.
Which makes it that much more important. Like, I would say, like, that means to me going to the place of discomfort.
Yes, the place of discomfort from a... Now we can tie this back into the improv. The place of discomfort in improv is maybe not knowing what's coming next, right? Sort of an anticipatory. And the place of discomfort in philosophy is not knowing what's true or having two opposing ideas in your head at the same time and trying to figure out which one is the right one. In my case, the way I like to articulate it for other people is putting your beliefs at risk, being willing to be wrong.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great place to exist from. Right? I call that living in the learning zone. Knowing what you know and also surrendering to the unknown. What if I could learn something? What if I'm wrong here? What if I have not considered the other person's point of view or experiences or the things that I cannot see? So what if I could suspend my judgment and instead of choosing judgment, choose curiosity?
this is what I mean. Mary is in the minority because most people,
story of my
most
life.
People don't do that. Yes.
Yeah. It's most not easy to do.
It's not easy to do. And it is scary.
It's
right?
scary. Yeah.
What my parents taught me or told me, or what my priest told me, or what my teacher told me.
Any leaders, mentor figures. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I'm very excited that the two of you decided to forego traditional couples therapy and come to the learning zone where we challenge fundamental beliefs.
I really love
about each other.
How many toys you have around. You've got a lot of different tchotchkes and stuff. Daryl, what do you think about all the tchotchkes in the office? Lots of toys.
The tchotchkes are nice, but you know, I don't want us to get distracted by all of the toys.
I know. I know. And I think that's, Dr. Sanderson, that's actually what we're here to talk about is lately I have been, oh, look at that. That's a bobblehead. Oh, that's cute. That's a Santa Claus. Sorry.
Doctor, this is what I'm talking about. She has a tendency to get distracted. I'm just wondering if maybe medication is in order.
Yeah. Thank you, honey.
Well, this is not a place for chemically changing people. This is a place for opening your minds through open and honest discussion and sometimes playing with the tchotchkes.
See, honey, listen to Dr. Sanderson. He's look at all the degrees, honey. I've never seen so many plaques behind a desk before. He's got more plaques than you do, sweetheart.
Mm. Well, then I suppose his opinion must be worth more than mine.
Oh, now don't you go. Don't be a crabby Kathy. Don't. See, okay, so doctor, here's what it is. Our latest issue is I'm very, very easily distracted. And my darling husband
is very judgmental.
Very judgmental. Accent on the mental. I'm sorry. Let me practice my breathing exercises. You go ahead.
You breathe. And I find that her getting distracted means that she's unable to learn, which is why we came to the learning zone.
That's right.
And I find that me being judgmental means I'm closed off to learning.
And you're not learning either. So we're at, doctor, I believe that the learning zone is going to save our marriage. And I just want to thank you for getting us in. I know you're very booked up months out. You're very popular.
Well, what an amazing level of openness you've come to the session today with. I'm very optimistic. Can you tell you a little bit about, you know, these, you're defining each other, distracted, you're judgmental, but the fact that you're able to identify that, doesn't that mean that on a particular circumstance, you could not be judgmental?
Yeah, instance. Honey, what do you think about that?
On a particular instance, could I not be judgmental?
Just try it
right.
For maybe once.
The fact that it's, you're not an animal, you're not just reacting. An animal is, if it's hungry, it's going to howl for food.
Right.
but you are a human being. You're aware. So you have the key to unlock your habits. And I know sometimes you can fall back to that animal habit and just be judgmental. But if you have an open mind, if you're in the moment, you can decide.
Look, honey,
you're
he's got
judge
a key. He's got, look at all those keys on the table.
Yep.
No. You can pick up your key, honey.
Well, if I were to try to do what you're saying, I would say I understand that my lovely and beloved wife is not the sum of her actions and is not actions. And so I can overlook and say that I still love her very much.
No. You say the sweetest things in the most condescending way, and that's one of the things I love about you, darling.
Now, being distracted is a little more difficult. That's a habit as well.
True.
But it seems like it's maybe that you're too open at every moment, if that's what distraction is you're...
I never thought about it that way, Dr.
Being open,
Sanderson.
Maybe you got to just like, just zip it. Just zip it a little bit. Just take the top, zip it. Just a little bit.
Oh, yes. Look at all those zippers. Oh, I like that one. That's purple and sparkly.
Yes, you can hold. I can hold the purple
sparkly zipper. Oh.
And we'll give your husband the big blue foam key.
Yeah, the big blue foam one so you don't hurt yourself.
And if you want to, you know, for a small rental fee, you can take these with you. And then as you're going through the next week, every time you're about to be distracted, you can grab the zipper.
Yeah.
You can focus on this. Every time your husband is going to be judgmental, then you can smack yourself right in the head with the key.
I was going to say, it's foam, so there's no injuries involved. But honey, you can't throw the zipper at me because that could cause an injury.
Wait, I have a key and you have a zipper.
I do.
Shouldn't you have a lock?
I mean, sometimes people are fundamentally incompatible.
Excuse me?
We gotta be open to that possibility.
Hold on a fucking second. Wait a minute.
Openness means openness to all possibilities.
Dr. Sanderson, shut your well-degreed pie hole. Honey, a lock?
Yes. Well, don't keys and locks go together? Isn't that the normal, as opposed to zippers and keys?
Oh, I'm so sorry. See, I was taking it personal, and that's on me. I'll zip it up. Hold on. Zip.
Wait. No, I was taking it literally. Too literally, perhaps.
Yeah, the lock is in you.
You
so
are
the key
lock,
is for
honey.
You.
The key to
it's not
unlock
to unlock
you.
Her.
It's you, not me. It's you. It's,
oh.
Yeah, once you fix yourself, then you're ready to interact with another person.
So
that's
you unlock,
fundamentally the,
you
the
unlock
thing with
your judgmentalness.
And you zip it.
And
zip it.
I do.
Zip it up.
I'll do it.
But I feel like the three of us might need an additional therapist to help.
I think that's a great idea.
We need meta therapy.
I feel like maybe you're not open to the possibility of a therapist who comes in with his own problems and maybe gets a little set off when somebody is like a little just throwing at things out there and not showing proper respect for the degrees, thinking
Dr.
that they know what's going on.
Dr. Sanderson, it sounds like you might need one of your healing wizard props.
I think you're right. You're right. I use this sponge.
Oh.
Let me get the sponge down. And then when I have the sort of aggression that seeing couples that are not getting along perfectly invariably inspires with me, and especially when it's the 10th of the day, as you folks are, then I just spit all that it's a sea sponge.
Thing. Have you ever tried screaming into a store-bought sheet cake?
Or a foam key.
Or a foam key. Or maybe you need to zip as well.
You know, honey, I feel much better about our relationship.
Oh, good, honey.
After hearing Dr. Sanderson's problems.
Dr. Sanderson, you're saving our marriage.
Yes, thank you so much.
Yay. All right.
And so, scene.
Cheers to Seth for remembering Dr. Sanderson's name.
Well
I find
done.
Remembering the names the hardest part.
Yeah.
And I should just
write
them down.
I only remembered it because Mary kept repeating
it. Well, there's
it,
a great so rule, and this is something that I've learned from David Rozowski, is that repetition is not redundancy. And there isn't anything wrong with that repetition. Repetition locks it in. I find when I'm teaching improv, sometimes there's a fear of silence. There's a fear of repeating, and it's absolutely okay. And it is very important, like as we launch into this scene, right, where anything and everything can happen, we're building a shared reality together. There's a real power in names because anything is possible. But once you lock it in and I give you a Daryl, like you are now Daryl, like it's more grounded. And Dr. Sanderson, which then led me to make the discovery of looking out in the environment about how many degrees he has. So I'm legitimizing Dr. Sanderson, but it's like, one thing leads to the next thing, but you can't get to the next thing unless you had the thing that happened before it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with philosophy. At least I tend to, you know, we're thinking about, oh, should we read this thing next? Oh, you know what? To really understand that, we should read these five other things first. Let's lay out the next 3 months of reading because we had one idea of something we wanted to read. And I feel like we should be prepared for that. I feel like maybe you are a little less anal than I am about that sort of thing, that maybe, you know, whatever it is, you could probably find some way in. You don't need to step up a ladder.
Talking to me or her?
Yes, that's a question for you,
Seth.
That's
a Seth question, yeah.
It's an eternal tension. Well, that made it sound very impressive.
It did sound very impressive, eternal
yes,
tension.
It's a constant tension between what you might call, you know, exploration and scholarship. So if you want to understand some 20th century commentary on this particular philosopher, you have to read that original philosopher's work and then the six commentaries in the century that came up before that this person would have read. You know, that's a scholarly way of approaching the subject. Or you can just say, I know what the original text was. Let's say I have an idea about what it was about, and I'm interested in this person's opinion. I'm going to see what the text gives me. And I'm going to experience the text just on its own. And we have this conversation frequently about authorial intent. I mean, that's really what this comes down to is like, is there some meaning and some way, some correct way of reading a work of philosophy or literature or poetry or anything like that that's mandatory? Like, I'm not legitimized because I don't know the history or the style or this sort of thing? Or can I experience the work of art directly itself, even if that experience is impoverished because I don't know the same things that you know or I haven't done the work? Some people will say yes, some people will say no.
Interesting.
And of course, as podcasters, we're giving people an experience either of describing the work directly, or in the case of this podcast, if I'm trying to teach, you know, Mary, have her go away with a tidbit that she did not have before, then it's really a matter of, here is a core idea that came from something. Do with it what you will. You can always go back to the source. You could always read yourself the text that I am butchering right now. But this is when philosophy, I know it's not an accident that you picked, you know, 20th century analytic philosophy, I think, for your example, because it gets such that even the questions they're trying to answer, like, are not normal questions that a human being would normally ask. Like, they're only because they were introduced by some way of putting things that the past philosopher did. So unless we can like untangle and bring out to the light and present to somebody who's not familiar with any of the literature, then we don't really understand it, or maybe it wasn't worth understanding.
What reference did Mary make to 20th century analytic philosophy?
Just I thought you did, Seth, the commentary.
Oh, yes. No. I mean, I was thinking, actually, Mary, we just read a philosopher named Luce Irigaray.
Irigaray. He sounds like a fun guy at parties.
That's the feminist that we mentioned last time.
Oh, she sounds even more fun then.
Yes. And she's part of this sort of squad of French feminist and French phenomenologist and French whatever. She's the one, it was her, right, that had a book called Marine Lover of Friedrich Nietzsche. And it's like already with that title, you should be excited, right?
Like, yeah, like, it got me excited. Like, I love Nietzsche. Yeah, yeah.
These are the kinds of things, like, it's common for French and German philosophers to oftentimes be citing or referring to or meaning, intending to talk about people from the past without explicitly saying their names, right? You know, and you have to kind of guess. And that's what I had in mind. Mark was a little bit more about that. The analytics, I'm not going to go off there. But anyway, the point being, what is the point? I don't have a point.
That is always the danger in talking about either of these things, is you follow the trail and then you forget how you got here. And so you recapitulate.
Well, but no, this raises a very interesting and important question for me. So I know what I get out of philosophy. I know what I get out of doing the podcast, which, by the way, is the creation of something in real time, present. That conversation is very much improvisational. The difference is we have a text, even if it's not literally giving us dialogue. But like at the end of the day, I can walk away from an episode of PEL and just be like, I'm totally confused, or, you know, I didn't learn anything new, or I might come away with, yeah, that was kind of interesting, or, oh my God, this is earth shaking, right? You know, but whatever the outcome is, we don't need a denouement. We don't need a closing or a denouement on our episodes. But it feels like with improv, there's tension and there's building, and that ultimately you're trying to land the plane. Like, are you trying to get like the final walk-off joke or the closing? Like, you're trying to build something together, which seems way harder than what we do.
Interesting points you're making. It isn't about landing a plane, because when we start, we don't even know what vehicle we're in. We have no idea what's about to happen. We are being inspired by something. Like, to use an example, in this last little conversation, you said the feminist squad. So my brain immediately, my brain goes from A to B to C, where I want to see, I would, if we were on stage right now, I would initiate a group scene where everyone is on stage, where I am the conductor of the group scene, and I lead that I'm some kind of superhero, and I am assembling the superhero squad.
Mm-hmm.
So the point of that is just to see everyone be a superhero. And then there will be a moment where it's a high moment where either the bit has been serviced, right? For this one, it's really just about the bit of everyone being able to go out and be a feminist superhero. And then when it's done, it's done. However, that scene of the group scene of the gathering of the feminist squad, someone else in the ensemble will be inspired to take it somewhere else. So there really isn't a point. There is no landing. There is no success. Really, what we're going for is to show real human life on stage and for one character or all characters to change and change forever. And then when someone hits a transformational moment, it will be a high. And either someone can pull the lights on that, you know, the person like the, I also do the stage management and the lights and stuff. And we're on the light board, really like fearlessly front footed on the edge of our seats, looking to pull the lights at the highest moment and take it out. So I feel like improvisation is more about showing these beautiful, flashy supernova moments in time. And it's less about accomplishing something or knowing that you've succeeded.
With that very clear and compassionate explanation.
Thanks, Darren. You're so sweet to me.
You make me realize that I probably have never seen improv live in a theater, that my idea about what it is something on television that
yes, it's you might be thinking like whose line is it anyway kind of stuff, right?
That's exactly what it is. Yes,
which that whose line is it anyway is not a really great representation of improvisation because I feel any of my improv friends listening groaning at that, or maybe some agreeing. That is short form improvisation. They're games for game's sake. They're designed to be short, bitty, and entertaining. And also something about, you know, how they do Whose Line Is It Anyway, is I was very saddened to find out in my later years that that's all like edited. And, you know,
they only show the stuff that works.
And I think part of improvisation is showing that real, raw human, the oopses and the laughs. Like some of my favorite moments in Saturday Night Live are when they corpse, which is the technical term for when the actor who is playing the character is broken and laughs, like their laugh comes out. So for anyone who's watching these videos, I said it before in my last episode with Mark, but it's really delicious and delightful because there was one time where I almost laughed, but I swallowed it back because it's not me that's on stage. It's, no one ever gave me on my character a name. I don't know what her name was. Denise? Maybe she was Denise. She seemed like a Denise to me. But it's my job to be Denise and to explore this point of view of this particular human in couples therapy.
Can't believe, Seth, you didn't even give your wife a name.
I'm learning the rules as I go. So
yeah.
Isn't
that life, right? We learn the rules as we go. We evaluate the rules that we have been given. And then we decide if those rules serve us in the reality that we're building and upholding moving forward. That was very philosophical of me, if I say
that
so
was very
myself.
Philosophical. That's what we need is the, you know, the t-shirts.
I'm learning too, like, Seth and Mark.
They say soccer is life or whatever.
Yeah.
You need one that says improv is life.
Yeah, but really and truly, by living by that improvisational mindset, by like looking at my life in that way, I'm so much happier, healthier, more inquisitive, playful, and available.
And I want to claim that on a philosophy podcast, we're not just group teaching. We're not just presenting the material. There are more efficient ways for people to get this material. In fact, if you just ask Google the question, now its AI will put together a reasonable answer for you. So if you want a 1 minute or a 10 minute summary of this work, you can just generate that. So it is not about, you know, successfully delivering the summary. It is about presenting for the world, people thinking in real time and grappling and coming to realizations and hopefully, you know, doing that in a way where we're interacting with each other to produce this thing. So I think it is fundamentally, even though it's not trying to create a narrative scene, it's still trying to, just like an improv scene is trying to discover something about the characters, about the situation, about logic or human nature itself. That's what we're doing. So it's really the same thing.
I'm really enjoying exploring these adjacent qualities between improvisation and philosophy. And Seth, you said something earlier that is standing out to me, to use my language of like sparkly and shiny and interesting, is that truth is relative. truth is not.
Did I say that?
No, but I'm kind of I'm saying it as a statement, but you said something about truth. And my extraction from what you were saying, which is also leading into a question, is truth relative or is truth absolute?
Actually, so this is exactly one of those kind of things, like, is beauty, you know, does outer beauty reflect inner beauty? Where, of course, philosophers have a lot of, you know, comic book guy, picky guy is going to come in. But I understand, given the context, I think, what you had in mind, right? So there's lots of harmless ways of saying, oh yeah, truth is relative in that different information is relevant to different circumstances. So if you're asking, what gender am I? Then, well, are you going to the doctor about to receive an organ transplant? Well, then a particularly biological answer is called for. Am I just on a bus and somebody's trying to determine how to address me? Well, that's a different circumstance. So in that case, truth is relative. And of course, we create the different terms of sex and gender just to pull those apart and make it easier so people don't have to ask for a context when we have. So that's what philosophers love to do, is they come up with different terms to disambiguate all these things.
If you either liked or didn't like Mark's answer, you're definitely not going to like my response to this. So,
well, honey, you're being judgmental. Allow me to have my own assertion. Thank you.
I am being judgmental. You're right. Denise.
Denise, yes. Thank you.
Before you can answer the question, so let me ask you this. What does it mean for something to be true for you? What does that mean to you? Because truth...
Such that it would be relative, yeah.
Just in general, like, how does truth work? What does it mean? Like, if you say this is true, you mean it's actual in the world, like it's a real thing, or it happened, or...
I would say true, like, is like something that I know. Like, truth is an absolute.
Yeah. I think of truth differently, and that's why it's a little more complicated for me, and maybe that's what you picked up on. So let me put it this way. Truth might be relative, but facts are not.
Mm.
So there is reality and there are facts, and they're absolute. The problem is we have to use language to describe those things. And so it's when we start talking about things, like you and I can stand in the middle of the street and the fact is we're going to get hit by a car, and it doesn't matter whether we believe it or not, whether we know it or not, whether it's true or not. That's the reality of things. It matters if it's true, right? No, it doesn't matter if it's true or not. I mean, because there's no language there. What I'm saying is, like, if we physically put ourselves into the world in harm's way, so to speak, it doesn't matter whether you say it's true or false or what have you. It's irrelevant, because the fact is we're in the world. It's when we start describing the thing that's a fact, you know, like, oh, you're being judgmental. Is that a fact? Or did you just give a name to something that you think, right?
So truth is like qualifying fact, but everyone's going to qualify it in different ways.
I think truth is like giving a name to fact and qualifying fact.
Like endowing it, like in improvisation when we make someone
exactly.
a person. Yeah.
And...
interesting.
There's a variety of different ways. Maybe you say an infinite number, but at least a variety of different ways that you can do that. So I think it's ultimately not that helpful to talk about truth being relative or whether truth, it's like, let's talk about the way we use language to fuck everything mm-hmm. up or fix it. Although nowadays it seems more fucking up than fixing.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, that unsatisfying note about the nature of truth.
I'm very satisfied,
we're out of
actually.
Time.
Yeah.
We were edging toward that the whole time. That's where we were going. We had that in mind from the very first things we said to each other. I'm so glad I got to introduce an old friend and a new friend here as we kick off this new season, a new adventure. Thanks, Seth. Thanks, Mary.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us on this journey. We hope you learned something.
Hmm. I certainly did.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.